Live from the historic parsonage of 19th century gospel minister George Norcross in downtown Carlisle, Pennsylvania. It's Iron Sharpens Iron, a radio platform on which pastors, Christian scholars, and theologians address the burning issues facing the church and the world today. Proverbs 27, verse 17 tells us, "Iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another." Matthew Henry said that in this passage, quote, "We are cautioned to take heed whom we converse with, and directed to have in view in conversation to make one another wiser and better." It is our hope that this goal will be accomplished over the next hour, and we hope to hear from you, the listener, with your own questions. Now here's our host, Chris Arnson.
Good afternoon, Cumberland County, Pennsylvania, Lake City, Florida, and the rest of humanity living on the planet Earth who are listening via live streaming at ironsharpensironradio.com. This is Chris Arnson, your host of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, wishing you all a happy Tuesday on this 19th day of June, 2018. I am delighted to have as my returning guest today, Thomas Garrett Isham, who is a published author, a former newspaper editor, a career journalist and licensed lay preacher in the Episcopal Church in the Diocese of Western Michigan, who will address his book, A Born-Again Episcopalian, The Evangelical Witness of Charles Pettit McIlvaine. And it's my honor and privilege to welcome you back to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, Tom Isham. I'm sorry.
Well, that's part of it. Yeah. Thank you, Chris. I'm glad to be back.
And we are supposed to be having join us as a special co-host today, Ken Samples. I don't know if he's joined us yet online, on the phone line. Ken, are you there? I guess he's not. But hopefully Ken will be calling in shortly. And some of you may recognize this theme and be mistaken in your belief that this is a rerun. It is not a rerun. It's not a rerun if you're listening on June 19th, 2018. Eventually, it will be a rerun. But I have interviewed someone else on this very same topic before, the Reverend Jacob Smith, who is the rector at the Parish of Calvary St. George's in Manhattan, a very biblically faithful congregation, at least today, and it was originally in its founding. It is the congregation of the great Stephen H. Ting, who was a low church Episcopalian and thoroughgoing Calvinist in the 19th century, who was the pastor there. And Jacob Smith, by the blessings of our Lord and by the grace of our God, has redirected the church back to its biblical roots, as was, I think, his predecessor as well. But he addressed this same topic because it was a very powerful influence. That book, the biography of Charles Pettit McIlvaine by our guest today, was a very powerful influence upon his life. And since the author of that biography is still with us here on the planet Earth, I figured that we might as well interview Thomas Garrett Isham himself on his own biography. And Ken Samples is still not with us. I'm hoping he joins us, but our original co-host was going to be Reverend Jacob Smith. I've known Reverend Jacob Smith for quite a long time, going back to 2005, I believe. But he could not make it because he had an important diocese. I always mispronounce that. I'm a former Roman Catholic, and I should know how to pronounce that. Diocese, or how do you pronounce that?
Well, let's see. It'd be a diocesan meeting.
Diocesan meeting. Yeah, there you go.
Right.
I guess I've been a Reformed Baptist so long that I've lost all the vocabulary of the Catholic Church. but we at least give our greetings to Reverend Jacob over the airwaves and hope that he is listening to this at least later on in a rerun or in a pre-recorded format. Before we go into the discussion at hand, why don't you give our listeners a bit of your background as an Episcopalian. I know that you gave this background the last time, but I think it's important that we revisit some of these things, because many evangelicals, for sure, when they hear the word Episcopalian, they can't believe that you're possibly talking about anyone who is born again. And in fact, hence the title of your book, Born Again Episcopalian. People either automatically go to one wing or another of the Episcopal Church, or even the Anglican Church. They automatically may think of either very Romish Oxford movement, Tractarian, Puseyite, Episcopalians and Anglicans who are extremely high church, who believe in many of the doctrines of Roman Catholicism that the Reformers rejected. My grandmother's priest while she was living in my parents' home when I was a little boy, all the way through my late teens, actually. Very nice man, Episcopal priest, but he was very Romish, and in fact is on the precipice of converting to Eastern Orthodoxy and bringing the entire congregation with him, because he's not a liberal. And then you have on the other end of the spectrum, you have the apostasy of the left, where you have those that not only may be in favor of homosexuality as a completely legitimate behavior for a Christian, and they may even have as their own ministers or priests, either male or female, homosexuals actively involved in that behavior, or it might be even theological apostasy where they don't even believe in the deity of Christ, the Trinity, or the bodily resurrection. So you have this, and I don't think I'm overstating the case, am I, Tom?
Not a bit. That's a good summary of our situation in the Episcopal Church.
But you do have a minority of very sound, faithful men, even Calvinists, who are 39 Articles men. And if you could tell us something about your own background, and then what eventually led you to write the biography of Charles Pettit McIlvaine, a born-again Episcopalian.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, what did I say before? Let me just sum up my background here. I was raised as a Presbyterian. As the sociologist would say, I was churched very much in my childhood and youth. I was in church every Sunday, so I grew up in the church. I was, like most young people, theologically unsophisticated, but we did get good sermons that had an impact on me. So I do appreciate that from my Presbyterian background. Now, after I left home and went to university at the age of 18, I drifted. That was typical, or I suppose is typical of many young people. They get away from home and they try new things in life. They're exposed to new influences. So I did drift around for a time. I eventually stumbled upon C.S. Lewis and read some of his apologetic books I was partway through my senior year, so I guess I've been drifting quite a while. So that was my first real exposure to a theologically astute writer and apologist. And so that changed my life. I didn't automatically become a devout Christian again, but there were certain things he said that I could not discount. So it certainly changed my more naturalistic view, which I had absorbed in college and I suppose in high school. I went to public schools, and even in those days, there was not, religion was certainly kept out of the school. So one got a scientific education, if you will, certainly a secular education. So anyway, it was Lewis who really turned me around. And then over the next decade or so, a few years later, I became an Episcopalian the age of 26. My wife is a cradle Episcopalian. And we had, when our oldest son was born, we thought we should get him baptized. That may seem like rather a lame excuse to start going to church, but it wasn't as if I was we were coming at it from totally out of the blue. I'd read a lot up to that point, and so I didn't feel uncomfortable or hypocritical. So we did join the church, and our son was duly baptized, and I have been an Episcopalian ever since for a number of decades now. So, and I have seen, living in southern Michigan, well, it's, as you pointed out, the Diocese of Western Michigan, is one of the most liberal Episcopal dioceses in the country, believe it or not. One would think of California or Massachusetts, and I suppose it's maybe tied with them, but it's very, very liberal. But it's maybe in my early 30s I came across my first real exposure to evangelical slash reformed theology, which Lewis had was, well, he was not really of that churchmanship. I mean, he was very conservative in his teaching and an excellent apologist, and I owe him a lot. But he, his Mere Christianity, for instance, just introduces people to just that. It was a phrase of Richard Baxter's from 300 or 400 years ago, Mere Christianity, just the basics of a traditional view of the Christian faith. And so I needed something a little more fine-tuned than that, and finally came across it by reading mostly J.I. Packer, who is an Anglican, British, moved to Canada in the late 70s and still lives in on the West Coast. Can't think of the city. It's a huge Vancouver. And so he was a big influence. John Stott, another Anglican Episcopalian or Anglican evangelical, was an influence. So anyway, they put me in the direction of a more reformed type of view. You also ask about McIlvaine, how I came across him. His dates, just to orient people, he was born in 1799, which was the year that George Washington died. I always think of that coincidence. And he lived until 1873, died at 74. So he had a fairly long life, especially for those days. So he's very much a 19th century figure. I actually came across his name in a book called Guarding the Holy Fire by Roger Steer, who is, I think he's English, but at any rate, that book was about evangelicals in the Anglican and Episcopal churches, and he had maybe 4 or 5 pages on this interesting-sounding man, this Charles Pettit McIlvaine. And so I just looked further into his life, and I was immediately drawn to him, both as a theologian, a pastor, a revivalist. He had all the talents that a clergyman could possibly have, and of course became bishop of Ohio in its frontier days, and remained bishop for 41 years, so that by the time he died in 1873, Ohio had been much more civilized than when he came there in 1832. So he saw great changes there and great growth in the Episcopal Church under his leadership.
Now, what
I think that's it in a capsule. Yeah.
What was the Episcopal Church like when he was a minister and then eventually a bishop? Obviously, you didn't have the more grotesque forms of Episcopalianism in existence back then. People would have been imprisoned probably back then if they had that real leftist mutation of Episcopalianism.
Right.
But,
yeah,
what else was he dealing with? Obviously, he was most likely dealing with some of the Romish influence, although
yeah.
I've heard that that really started to return heavily in the 19th century. But tell us about what he faced as an Episcopalian.
Yeah, well, he it was in 1811, of course, he would have only been 12 then, that the Episcopal Church, which had fallen on rather hard times because many of its members were Tories during the Revolution, and so it was not the most popular church in the early decades after the American Revolution, but it did start to grow again, and in 1811, a theological division emerged between a low church and high church approach, and and low church being the evangelical wing and high church being the more Catholic wing. So by 1811, there was a real self-definition, them and us. I don't mean these people were hostile with each other. I mean, they were Christians, but they had definite opinions, which did divide on certain issues. But certainly from the standpoint of today's liberalism or revisionism, no, that wasn't even a gleam in their eye. I mean, they couldn't imagine what's going on today. But McIlvain what did he have to contend with? With the high church, because he did make some enemies in the high church who simply were not at all sympathetic with the evangelical wing. So there was that conflict.
Which was dominant?
Which was dominant
at his time?
Question. By his time, by the 1840s, the high church and low church were almost equal in the House of Bishops. And I assume the lay populations were roughly similar, too. So that was really the high point of evangelical Episcopalianism in the 1840s, and I suppose into the 1850s. So he was the acknowledged leader of the evangelical Episcopalians. Not only was he the Bishop of Ohio and president of a seminary there, that was part of the job. It's Kenyon College, and the seminary has moved away from there. They still had the college there. He had to contend with the high church folks, but then, as you mentioned, the Tractarian movement began in Britain in the 1830s, and it seeped over into the United States. And so he ended up, he was always had his finger on the pulse of things, he ended up authoring the definitive rebuttal of the Tractarian movement, which, of course, high churchmen, not all, but a lot of them were quite sympathetic to it and adopting certain ideas that were crossing the Atlantic.
Right, and in fact, there are even today some high church Anglicans who are thoroughgoing Calvinists, although they would probably be in the minority.
They would definitely be in the minority, right. But yeah, in 1841, he published it's really his magnum opus. It's a 500-page book, and as I say, it was really the last word on the evangelical rebuttal of the Tractarian movement and its growing influence in the United States as well. So he was, of course, tackling the work of John Henry Newman and Edward Pusey. I think you mentioned him, John Keeble, and a number of other notable churchmen.
Yeah, and John Henry Newman is a very crucial figure in this whole discussion because he was an Episcopalian or Anglican who converted to Roman Catholicism.
Right, and that had been one of the arguments. Actually, McIlvain didn't mention it, but a number of evangelicals said, well, this is just a foot in the door for Rome, this whole movement. And lo and behold, John Henry Newman, who is probably the most distinguished of the Tractarians, did eventually convert to Rome and became a cardinal, although that was a cardinal. I don't think he was a governing cardinal, but he was. That's the Romans, I believe. They honor certain scholarly people by giving them the title cardinal. But
right. And the thing that disturbs me most about John Henry Newman, and I know that I've said this before on this program, but I think it bears repeating because his quote is so often repeated by Roman Catholic apologists, and it infuriates me because it's, I think, a lie. He said, Henry Newman said, that to be steeped in history is to cease to be Protestant. And I have found the exact opposite to be true in my whole life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned that, I believe, in the last program where we talked, and I remember that. I agree with you totally. But this book, it's a wonderful read. I mean, if you have a theological aptitude or interest, I'll read you the title, which in those days there were some long titles. It was named Oxford Divinity, of course, referring to the, Tractarians who were centered at Oxford University. Oxford Divinity, compared with that of the Romish and Anglican churches, with a special view of the doctrine of justification by faith, which, of course, was an emphasis that McIlvain made. But that was the long title, and as I say, it became the last word, and it was used as a text in Episcopal seminaries for many, many decades because it was so well done. He was such a talented writer, too, and there's nothing dry in his writing. And so, yeah, it was a fine book. If you want to jump ahead a little bit, and you said what else did he contend with? The grandfather, if you will, of the today's liberalism entered the Anglican Church in 1860. Oh, I suppose it had been in there to some extent before, but it became more publicly involved in Anglicanism in a book put out by seven British scholars, six of them clergy and one was a bishop, and it was a book called Essays and Reviews, which became notorious because it really laid out the liberal view of Christianity, which in basics has not changed. I mean, of course, the homosexual issues and other things that are more involved in our times came along later, but if the basic views on biblical criticism, the higher criticism, which they got from the German academies, and all the basic foundation of liberalism was there, and that came out in 1860, and McIlvain wrote a rejoinder. Now, this was nothing like the 500-page Oxford Divinity book. This was actually in the form of a letter, but it was a long letter. I mean, it was, I don't know, 60, 70 pages, and he wrote, in rebuttal of it, McIlvain did, called rationalism as exhibited in the writings of certain clergymen of the Church of England, subtitled A Letter to the Clergy and Candidates for Holy Orders of the Protestant Episcopal Church in the United States. And it addresses those basic foundational views of the early liberals. And one thing that, well, among many things that annoyed McIlvain is that he said most of what they say is really just warmed over deism, which had gone out of style. That was more a late 17th and 18th century form of what he would call infidelity. But he said really it's basically warmed over deism. The only difference is that this is right within the church. Six of these people are clergy, six of the seven who wrote these essays. One is a bishop, and they're all on the payroll. They're all have distinguished posts in the universities. And here they're undermining the very church that supports them. So that, I mean, he was such a straightforward, honest man that he just did not budge an inch on giving them any credit.
Hey, Chris, can you hear me?
Now we have Ken Samples joining us. Ken Samples is co-hosting the program today. There was a mix-up, I understand, with the Pacific time versus the Eastern time. Ken is in California. He is former senior research consultant and correspondence editor at the Christian Research Institute, also known as CRI, and he's the former co-host of the Bible Answer Man radio broadcast. He is currently a senior research scholar at Reasons to Believe and a member of a conservative, biblically faithful Anglican church, and it's my honor and privilege to welcome you back to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, this time, for the very first time, as a co-host, Ken Samples.
Hey, thank you. I'm sorry I'm butting in here late, but I've been listening to your interview, and it's really good to be with both of you. I've found the conversation very interesting, so thank you for including me.
Well, why don't we start at this point, Ken, as far as your involvement is concerned, is how you were drawn. I know that you have been involved in Presbyterian churches and United Reformed Church of North America congregations, the Dutch Reformed wing of the Protestant faith, and now you find yourself in an Anglican church. What drew you to want to even consider joining an Anglican church? And tell us something about the specific congregation where you are attending.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I, of course, grew up kind of in a nominal Catholic family. You know, my parents converted to Catholicism in the early 60s, and I wasn't terribly well catechized, but when I was early college student, various events in my life kind of led me to become interested in Christianity, and I was kind of part of a Catholic charismatic community. There were, interestingly, Catholics reading the Bible and talking about Jesus in very evangelically sounding terms, it seemed to me. But through meeting Walter Martin, who was the original Bible Answer Man, I embraced a Protestant evangelical faith. And sometime later, of course, I began to engage a Reformed theology, and I was very attracted to that. I was attracted to the intellectual rigor in the Reformed tradition. I was attracted to a view of God that I thought really acknowledged the sovereignty of the Lord. And yet, I always liked liturgy. I always appreciated liturgy. I like a very strong Trinitarian element in the service. And I was always impressed with the 39 Articles, which are not only Protestant, but distinctly Reformed. And so I liked that kind of element. I appreciated that kind of element. And so I was attracted to some of the aesthetic sides of the Anglican Church. The church that I attend is part of the Anglican Church of North America. It's a small group, as your guest and you, Chris, know. Many of the churches that have resisted the more liberal theological influence of, have had to move into much smaller congregations. But I really like the... I love the 39 Articles. I am also a student of C.S. Lewis. I was just recently in the kilns where he lived, and so I like that aspect very much. So that's kind of the background, the tradition. It is interesting. You have Anglicans that are very much Reformed. You have others that hold more of a Wesleyan, Arminian, assorted type of faith, but... I appreciate the history, I appreciate the theology, and I mourn. I was in Australia a couple years ago, and a very conservative Anglican theologian said, stay away from the American Episcopal Church. they were very, very concerned about the state of the Episcopal Church in America.
Now, were they from Sydney in Australia?
Yes,
yeah,
they were.
Because even in Australia, they have a lot of liberalism, but the Sydney folks seem to be the most conservative that I've heard of in Australia. I'm gonna take a question from a listener before we go to the break, and perhaps you can answer it, Tom, when we return. And, of course, Ken, if you have anything to add. And Ken, since I cannot see you, I'm asking you to butt into the conversation whenever you have a question, because I can't see any kind of facial expressions or waving hands or anything.
Very good.
But we have a listener, Susan, who is actually bi-residential. She is from Setauket, Long Island, New York, and Scottsville, Kentucky. And she has a question that is very relevant to what we are discussing right now. She says, or asks, how influential was the Oxford movement to the demise of evangelicalism in the Episcopal Church? And we're going to have both Tom and, if Ken has anything to say, also answer that when we return from our first break. If anybody would like to join us on the air with a question of your own, our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com, chrisarnson@gmail.com. Please give us your first name, your city and state, and your country of residence if you live outside the USA, and only remain anonymous if you have a private and personal question.
Hi, I'm Chris Arnson, host of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, here to tell you about an exciting offer from World Magazine, my trusted source for news from a Christian perspective. Try World at no charge for 90 days and get a free copy of R.C. Sproul's book, Relationship Between Church and State. I rely on World because I trust the reporting. I gain insight from the analysis. and World provides clarity to the news stories that really matter. I believe you'll also find World to be an invaluable resource to better understand critical topics with a depth that's simply not found in other media outlets. Armed with this coverage, World can help you to be a voice of wisdom in your family and your community. This trial includes bi-weekly issues of World Magazine, on-scene reporting from World Radio, and the fully shareable content of World Digital. Simply visit wmg.org/ironsharpens to get your World trial and Dr. Sproul's book all free. No obligation with no credit card required. Visit World News Group at wng.org/ironsharpens today.
Hi, I'm Pastor Bill Shishko, inviting you to tune in to A Visit to the Pastor's Study every Saturday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Eastern Time on WLIE Radio, www.wlie540am.com. We bring biblically faithful pastoral ministry to you, and we invite you to visit the pastor's study by calling in with your questions. Our time will be lively, useful, and I assure you, never dull. Join us this Saturday at 12 noon Eastern Time for a visit to the pastor's study, because everyone needs a pastor.
Iron Sharpens Iron welcomes Solid Rock Remodeling to our family of sponsors. Serving South Central Pennsylvania, Solid Rock Remodeling is focused on discovering, understanding, and exceeding your expectations. They deliver personalized project solutions with exceptional results. Solid Rock Remodeling offers a full range of home renovations, including kitchen and bath remodeling, decks, porches, windows and doors, roof and siding, and more. For a clear, detailed professional estimate, call this trustworthy team of problem solvers who provide superior results that stand the test of time. Call Solid Rock Remodeling at 717-697-1981, 717-697-1981, or visit solidrockremodeling.com. That's solidrockremodeling.com. Solid Rock Remodeling, bringing new life to your home.
Charles Haddon Spurgeon once said,
"Give yourself unto reading. The man who never reads will never be read. He who never quotes will never be quoted. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read."
Solid Ground Christian Books is a publisher and book distributor who takes these words of the Prince of Preachers to heart. The mission of Solid Ground Christian Books is to bring back treasures of the past to minister to Christians in the present and future, and to publish new titles that address burning issues in the church and the world. Since its beginning in 2001, Solid Ground has been committed to publish God-centered, Christ-exalting books for all ages. We invite you to go treasure hunting at solid-ground-books.com. That's solid-ground-books.com and see what priceless literary gems from the past or present you can unearth from Solid Ground. Solid Ground Christian Books is honored to be a weekly sponsor of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
And you can get A Born-Again Episcopalian, The Evangelical Witness of Charles Pettit McIlvaine, the book that we are discussing today by my guest Thomas Isham. You can get that for 50% off. The list price is $24. You can get it for $12 at solid-ground-books.com, solid-ground-books.com. Please tell the folks at Solid Ground Christian Books that you heard about them from Chris Arnson on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. I want to thank all of you in the Iron Sharpens Iron Radio audience who have been faithfully remembering to do that very thing. You've been telling Mike Gadosh, the founder of Solid Ground Christian Books, that you heard about him from our radio program. And as a result, he has been reading me periodically very long lists of people that I have never even heard from before, who have mentioned to him that they heard about solid-ground-books.com from Chris Arnson on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. I am so delighted and so thankful that you have been not only responding to the ads, but you've been telling him that you've been hearing about him from us. And That hasn't been always the case with other of our advertisers, so please continue to do that with not only solid-ground-books.com, but with all of our advertisers when you patronize them. And we are now back with Thomas Garrett Isham, who is the author of A Born-Again Episcopalian, The Evangelical Witness of Charles Pettit McIlvaine, and we also have co-hosting the program Kenneth R. Samples, who is also an author, and he's the senior research scholar at Reason to Believe, and a conservative Anglican. If you'd like to join us on the air, our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com, chrisarnson@gmail.com. And Sue, from both Setauket, Long Island, and Scottsville, Kentucky, asked before the break, how influential was the Oxford movement to the demise of the evangelicalism in the Episcopal Church? Tom?
Yeah. The short answer is it is definitely a factor, or was definitely a factor. What happened in the 1860s and into the early 1870s, there was quite a bit of debate about revising the prayer book. We have those debates every few years or every few decades in the Episcopal Church. And that did further divide the evangelicals and the high church on some important issues. And the high church had, over the recent decades, become more Catholic in its in certain elements, and that was due to the Tractarian movement. And following the Civil War, which would be that ended in 1865, there was a lot of wealth created in this country, of course. We became more or less an industrial giant, much of it due from the war industries, and were converted to commercial use. A lot of the high church became increasingly what they called Anglo-Catholic, and so you can see the Catholicizing influence in the last decades of the 19th century.
In fact, I know and have communicated with a number of Anglo-Catholics who refuse to identify themselves as Protestant in any way.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's par for the course, yes.
Right.
Yes, and so the term Anglo-Catholic became more and more used among people with high church inclinations. Another term used was ritualism, which kind of speaks for itself. And with all that new money in this society, a lot of ornate, beautiful churches were built by the Anglo-Catholic, people in the Anglo-Catholic wing. And it just became more established within the Episcopal Church. As I said before, the evangelicals were maybe close to half of the church and close to half of the House of Bishops in the 1840s. Well, that after the Civil War, that changed. And the Anglo-Catholics did become more powerful. Plus, the liberal influences started to grow in the 1870s and 1880s, and that had to do with a lot of new wealth, too. People were looking more to this world for their happiness. I mean, even church people, because there was so much to take advantage of, better health, better sanitation, better homes. So, and then the low church in the early 1870s had a split. The group that split off became the Reformed Episcopal Church. And that stemmed from various battles over the revising the prayer book. So you had a weakened low church presence, and it continued to weaken throughout the last decades of the 19th century. The two directions were this Anglo-Catholic / ritualism group, the old high church people, becoming ever more Catholic and ever more ornate and fussy in their liturgy and their church buildings, and then you had this growing liberal thinking, which I touched on that, and had come in Britain a few decades earlier, a couple decades. So from Britain and the German academies, the liberal, pretty much by the turn of the 20th century, the Episcopal Church was composed of the Anglo-Catholics on one side and the liberals on the other, and the evangelicals were just a few remnants here and there, which is quite an amazing decline
And this is what this is what this is what year? I'm sorry that this reached this point.
Well, by the turn of the 20th century,
okay,
the evangelical low church was reduced to various remnants here and there, but it had no real power and very little influence. Part of that problem had actually begun years earlier. It had not really shown up for decades, but just briefly in the 1830s, the low church represented, McIlvaine had a hand in this, unfortunately. He didn't have a crystal ball or a prophetic enough nature to see the consequences, but he and the high church folks sat down in the 1830s and decided which group was going to run the foreign missions and which group was going to run the domestic missions. Well, the high church got the domestic missions, which meant they were going to be planting their churches all over this country. And the low church was going to be sending a lot of missionaries overseas, which was great for Africa or Asia or wherever these people were sent, and still has an influence to this day. But that did favor, over the decades, favored the high church folk, which later morphed into the more Anglo-Catholic and ritualistic wing of the church. So anyway, by 1900, the low church in the Episcopal Church was reduced to, as I say, just remnants. And then it was reborn in the late 50s, early 1960s, and has a very vocal presence to this at this point, although it's a very small part of the church.
We have another listener. We have, let's see, Susan Margaret in Dauphin County, Pennsylvania, who says, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that the great low church Anglican bishop, who was also a Calvinist, J.C. Ryle in England, was a contemporary of McIlvaine. And if I am correct on that, do you know of any correspondence or friendship between the two of them?
We have another Susan here. I am unaware of any contact between them. They are roughly contemporaries. McIlvaine was born in 1799, and I believe Ryle was born in 1816. McIlvaine died in 1873, and I believe Ryle died in 1900. Interesting, right? The turn of the century. Certainly, theologically, although they had no personal contact, they certainly would have been in agreement. Now, Ryle, of course, became Bishop of Liverpool, and that became a real evangelical diocese under his influence. In fact, I think it was a new diocese, and he was its first bishop, and that would have been in 1880, I think. And McIlvaine, had been dead by 7 years by then. So, yeah, they're relatively close in historic terms, but there is like a half a generation difference. And so as far as I know, there was no personal correspondence. But McIlvaine did visit Britain no less than, I believe, six times in his life. He was a real Anglophile and knew many notable people, both political and ecclesiastical, in Britain. I just don't know how, you know, as I say, he died in 1873, how well-known Ryle was at that point. So they may have met, but I'm not aware of it.
We have John in Bangor, Maine, who asks, why is it that liberalism seems to have completely swallowed the Episcopal Church, even though it has such a rich history of biblical faithfulness, including the 39 articles that were drafted by Thomas Cranmer, also a very strong Calvinist?
Boy, that is a good question. How did it all happen?
Well, do you think that a part of it has to do with when a church that is historically and traditionally confessional starts to view the confession as an antiquated document that does not need to be highly considered?
Well, that certainly was true of the liberals, and of course, in the case of the Anglo-Catholics, now you had a lot of Anglo-Catholics who were very conservative theologically, although they began to, there was a certain liberalization even among the Anglo-Catholics, and they were so concerned with liturgy that they didn't, their instincts were not confessional in the way that evangelicals would be.
Yeah, they certainly wouldn't have been fond of the 39 articles because it identifies the Roman Mass as idolatrous and other things that are clearly not Roman Catholic in the...
Right. They would have no truck with that, and obviously the liberals would have no interest with any confessional documents. In fact, the last two prayer books for the Episcopal Church, the one was in 1929, and the next one was in, I think it's 1979, which is the one I've used most of my Episcopal life. I was exposed to the 29 prayer book when I was first an Episcopalian for 3-4 years. But anyway, the point I was going to make there is that the 39 articles are in the back of both of those books, even the 29 book. And in the 79 book, they're in the historical documents, kind of like a dusty old museum that they put in the back near the Athanasian Creed in the back of the book. So, and I've never heard I've been through 5 rectors or so at our current parish. I've never heard any of them speak about the 39 articles unless they spoke of them dismissively. I mean, but they've all been liberals too, so it proves the point. They have no interest in confessional type teaching.
We have a listener in Lindenhurst, Long Island, CJ, who says or asks, do you know much of anything about Bishop McIlvaine's biblical ecumenism? I am not speaking here of ecumenical relationships with the Church of Rome or with liberal apostates, but with other biblically faithful denominations, congregations, and fellowships. It seems that sometimes churches like the Episcopal and Anglican Church and the Lutheran Church, even though there may be many faithful men amongst them, they tend to isolate themselves too much and are not very much involved in participation with fellowship with Baptists and Presbyterians and others who love the Scriptures and proclaim them.
Excellent question, and yes, McIlvaine was ecumenical in that regard, although he was a stalwart Episcopalian, never wavered in that. He did work with other, and evangelicals, low churchmen in general, worked with other denominations. He was very active in Bible societies, distributing Bibles and tracts to to foreign places and in throughout this nation. They cooperated on that, and he got along with them very well. And he was actually educated at Princeton, which was the College of New Jersey in those days, and went to Princeton Seminary. The reason he did that, the specific reason, was the Episcopal Church did not yet have a seminary of its own, and we're talking the mid-1816, 1817. Now, in 1820, the High Church established a general seminary in New York City, which is still around, and extremely liberal. But that was, McIlvaine was through with the seminary by then, so he had had gotten a Presbyterian seminary education, but that's fairly harmonious with low church teaching. It's Presbyterians do not have the liturgy that Episcopalians have, but they have the same confessional instincts, at least the traditional Presbyterians. So he was comfortable working with them. In fact, Charles Hodge was a lifelong friend of his. Charles Hodge was a classmate, and he became the principal of Princeton Seminary and a professor there for many, many decades. And it was one of those stalwart old Princeton theology figures from the 19th century, and he was a good friend of McIlvaine's their entire lives. So McIlvaine was very relaxed at working with other churches to spread the word. They remained in their denominations, but they got along very well. And this is opposed to the High Church and the Episcopal Church. High churchmen were very finicky about who they would do things with. In fact, I don't think they did anything with people outside their denomination. The McIlvain did, yes. And there were a number of societies, Bible societies, tract societies, and I wish I could put my finger on that page. I've got the book here, but he was very active in that sort of thing with other church people, other denominations.
We have Ted in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, who says, has your guest encountered the redrafted liturgy by the late Peter Toon and the Prayer Brook Society? And if so, could he please comment on that liturgy?
No. In a word, no. Sorry to let you down. And no, I'm not familiar with that. I did have quite a correspondence with Peter Toon, though, who unfortunately died a rather untimely death a few years ago. In fact, he wrote a blurb for the back of my book.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'll read it. It's short. Where is the one
sure.
He did?
Well, you're looking for it.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
I've got it, but go ahead if you want.
Oh, I was just going to repeat our email address. If anybody wants to join us on the air with a question, our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, what this I attributed to it, the late Reverend Dr. Peter Toon, author of The End of Liberal Theology and former president of the Prayer Book Society of the USA. Yeah, he wrote this valuable work. Thank you, Peter. This valuable work on the great Victorian evangelical bishop of Ohio brings to light the story of an eminent theologian, revivalist, and churchman. McIlvain ought to be better known in our day. It is a great omission among Episcopalians in North America that he is not. By his many works and contributions, he speaks today. And as I did mention, his works are, one can get copies of them. Sometimes it's hard to get them. And then you can read my book, which has a lot of information about his theology as well as his life and the more practical aspects of being a bishop.
We are going to... Ken.
Peter Toon was one of the people that I read that had a big influence on me in terms of the Anglican School of Theology. Toon has a terrific book entitled Our Triune God, A Biblical Portrayal of the Trinity. It's a remarkably good work on the Trinity. And before his death, which... he had some immune disorder disease and died a few years ago, but he worked here in America on an Anglican prayer book that is available, and all of Toon's books are available free on the web to be downloaded. He gave all the rights up, but I've always appreciated Peter Toon very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for adding that. Yeah, I appreciated him too.
Well, we're going to our midway break right now. This is a longer than normal break because Grace Life Radio in Lake City, Florida, 90.1 FM in Lake City, Florida, they require of us a 12-minute break between our two major segments because they have their own commercials and public service announcements and other things that they air. So please be patient during this elongated break. Use this time not only to write questions for my guest, Thomas Isham, and if you have a question for Ken Samples as well, my co-host today, you can feel free to send us a question for Ken. And also, please write down the information provided by our advertisers so that you can patronize them. That's chrisarnson@gmail.com is our email address if you'd like to join us on the air with a question of your own. chrisarnson@gmail.com. And as always, please give us your first name, your city and state, and your country of residence if you live outside the USA. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
One sure way all Iron Sharpens Iron radio listeners can help keep my show on the air is to support my advertisers. I know you all use batteries every day, so I'm urging you all from now on to exclusively use BatteryDepot.com for all your battery needs. At BatteryDepot.com, they're changing the status quo. They're flipping the script. They're sticking it to the man. In other words, they'd like to change the battery industry for good by providing an extensive inventory of top-of-the-line batteries that are uniformly new, dependable, and affordable. Ordering from BatteryDepot.com ensures you'll always get fresh out-of-the-box batteries you can count on to work properly at competitive prices. Whether you need batteries for cordless phones, cell phones, radios, PCs, laptops, tablets, baby monitors, hearing aids, smoke detectors, credit card readers, digital cameras, electronic cigarettes, GPSs, MP3 players, watches, or nearly anything else you own that needs batteries, go to BatteryDepot.com. Next day shipping available. All products protected by 30-day guarantees and 6-month warranties. Call 866-403-3768. That's 866-403-3768. Or go to BatteryDepot.com. That's BatteryDepot.com.
Have you been blessed by Iron Sharpens Iron Radio? We remain on the air because of our faithful sponsors and because of listeners like you. There are 4 ways you can help. First, do you know potential sponsors who may wish to advertise their goods or services on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio? Second, whenever possible, purchase the products or use the services that our sponsors advertise, and then let them know that you heard about them on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. Thirdly, you can also donate to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio by going to our website at ironsharpensironradio.com and click support at the top of the page. But most importantly, keep Iron Sharpens Iron Radio in your prayers. We hope that Iron Sharpens Iron Radio blesses you for many years to come.
Iron Sharpens Iron Radio is sponsored by Harvey Cedars, a year-round Bible conference and retreat center nestled on the Jersey Shore. Harvey Cedars offers a wide range of accommodations to suit groups up to 400. For generations, Christians have enjoyed gathering and growing at Harvey Cedars. Each year, thousands of high school and college students come and learn more about God's Word. An additional 9,000 come annually to Harvey Cedars as families, couples, singles, men, women, pastors, seniors, and missionaries. 90 miles from New York City, 70 miles from Philly, and 95 miles from Wilmington, and easily accessible, scores of notable Christian groups frequently plan conferences at Harvey Cedars, like the Navigators, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, Campus Crusade, and the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. Find Harvey Cedars on Facebook or at hcbible.org. hcbible.org. Call 609-494-5689. 609-494-5689. Harvey Cedars, where Christ finds people and changes lives.
Every day at thousands of community centers, high schools, middle schools, juvenile institutions, coffee shops, and local hangouts, Long Island Youth for Christ, staff and volunteers meet with young people who need Jesus. We are rural and urban, and we are always about the message of Jesus. Our mission is to have a noticeable spiritual impact on Long Island, New York, by engaging young people in the lifelong journey of following Christ. Long Island Youth for Christ has been a stalwart bedrock ministry since 1959. We have a world-class staff and a proven track record of bringing consistent love and encouragement to youths in need all over the country and around the world. Help honor our history by becoming a part of our future. Volunteer, donate, pray, or all of the above. For details, call Long Island Youth for Christ at 631-385-8333. That's 631-385-8333. Or visit liyfc.org. That's liyfc.org.
Tired of box store Christianity? Of doing church in a warehouse with all the trappings of a rock concert? Do you long for a more traditional and reverent style of worship? And how about the preaching? Perhaps you've begun to think that in-depth biblical exposition has vanished from Long Island. Well, there's good news. Wading River Baptist Church exists to provide believers with a meaningful and reverent worship experience, featuring the systematic exposition of God's Word. And this loving congregation looks forward to meeting you. Call them at 631-929-3512 for service times. 631-929-3512. Or check out their website at wrbc.us. That's wrbc.us.
I'm James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries. The New American Standard Bible is perfect for daily reading or in-depth study. Used by pastors, scholars, and everyday readers, the NASB is widely embraced and trusted as a literal and readable Bible translation. The NASB offers clarity and readability while maintaining high accuracy to the original languages, which the NASB is known for. The NASB is available in many editions like a topical reference Bible. Researched and prepared by biblical scholars devoted to accuracy, the new topical reference Bible includes contemporary topics relevant to today's issues. From compact to giant print Bibles, find an NASB that fits your needs very affordably at nasbible.com. Whichever edition you choose, trust, discover, and enjoy the NASB for yourself today. Go to nasbible.com. That's nasbible.com.
Hi, I'm Pastor Bill Shishko, inviting you to tune in to A Visit to the Pastor's Study every Saturday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Eastern Time on WLIE Radio, www.wlie540am.com. We bring biblically faithful pastoral ministry to you, and we invite you to visit the pastor's study by calling in with your questions. Our time will be lively, useful, and I assure you, never dull. Join us this Saturday at 12 noon Eastern Time for a visit to the pastor's study, because everyone needs a pastor.
Charles Haddon Spurgeon once said,
"Give yourself unto reading. The man who never reads will never be read. He who never quotes will never be quoted. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read."
Solid Ground Christian Books is a publisher and book distributor who takes these words of the Prince of Preachers to heart. The mission of Solid Ground Christian Books is to bring back treasures of the past to minister to Christians in the present and future, and to publish new titles that address burning issues in the church and the world. Since its beginning in 2001, Solid Ground has been committed to publish God-centered, Christ-exalting books for all ages. We invite you to go treasure hunting at solid-ground-books.com. That's solid-ground-books.com, and see what priceless literary gems from the past or present you can unearth from Solid Ground. Solid Ground Christian Books is honored to be a weekly sponsor of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Thrivent Financial is not your typical financial services provider. As a membership organization, we help Christians be wise with money and live generously every day. And for the fourth year in a row, we were named one of the world's most ethical companies by the Ethisphere Institute, a leading international think tank dedicated to the creation, advancement, and sharing of best practices in business ethics. Contact me, Mike Gallagher, financial consultant, at 717-254-6433. Again, 717-254-6433 to learn more about the Thrivent Difference.
We know we were made for so much more than ordinary life.
Blending faith, finances, and generosity. That's the Thrivent story.
We were made to thrive.
Hi, I'm Buzz Taylor, frequent co-host with Chris Arnson on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. I would like to introduce you to my good friends Todd and Patty Jennings at CVBBS, which stands for Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service. Todd and Patty specialize in supplying Reformed and Puritan books and Bibles at discount prices that make them affordable to everyone. Since 1987, the family-owned and operated book service has sought to bring you the best available Christian books and Bibles at the best possible prices. Unlike other book sites, they make no effort to provide every book that is available because, frankly, much of what is being printed is not worth your time. That means you can get to the good stuff faster. It also means that you don't have to worry about being assaulted by the pornographic, heretical, and otherwise faith-insulting material promoted by the secular book vendors. Their website is cvbbs.com. Browse the pages at ease, shop at your leisure, and purchase with confidence as Todd and Patty work in service to you, the church, and to Christ. That's Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service at cvbbs.com. That's cvbbs.com. Let Todd and Patty know that you heard about them on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
And you can call cvbbs.com at their toll-free number, 800-656-0231, 800-656-0231. If you purchase at least $50 worth of merchandise and you mention Chris Arnzen on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, you will receive not only a free copy of the book by Derek Thomas, Taken Up to Heaven, you will also, on top of that, receive free shipping on everything that you order. That's if you order $50 or more and mention Chris Arnzen and Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. And you don't have to worry about Derek Thomas's book, Taken Up to Heaven, if you have some kind of apprehension that it's one of those weird, phony, heretical books about people who have visited heaven and has nothing to do with that. Derek Thomas is a world-renowned, biblically solid Calvinist and Presbyterian pastor, currently, I believe, serving in South Carolina. So I hope that you enjoy that book. Before we return to our discussion today with Thomas Isham and Ken Samples on Brother Isham's book, A Born-Again Episcopalian, The Evangelical Witness of Charles Pettit McIlvaine, we just have a couple of very important announcements to make. First of all, the Hope Reformed Baptist Church of Medford, Long Island, New York, is having, as a guest speaker, my dear friend Dr. Tony Costa, on Sunday, July 1st, and if you'd like to attend that meeting, go to hopereformedli.net for more details, hopereformedli for Long Island.net, and you could also call Hope Reformed Baptist Church in Medford, Long Island at 631-696-5711, 631-696-5711. And that following Friday, Dr. Costa will be speaking at an event that I am orchestrating or have orchestrated along with my friend Pastor Andy Woodard of the New Covenant Church in New York City. We are having Dr. Tony Costa in the heart of Manhattan provide a free seminar. It will be held at the First Baptist Church of New York City, a very historic church dating back to the 1700s. One of the earlier pastors of that church was actually the personal chaplain of George Washington. It's located on 79th and Broadway in Manhattan's Upper West Side. Dr. Costa will be speaking on defending the faith in a postmodern society. He'll also be speaking on the dangers of cultural Marxism's impact on society and the church. And he's also going to have a Q&A session with the audience. If you would like to attend this event, and I'm begging you, please, spread the word like wildfire about this event, because I want to see as many Iron Sharpens Iron Radio listeners as possible at this event. Call the New Covenant Church in New York City at 646-770-2282, 646-770-2282. You can also email Pastor Andy Woodard at the New Covenant Church in New York City at nccnycinfo@gmail.com. That's NCC, standing for New Covenant Church. NYC, for New York City, info@gmail.com. Or you can email me, chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com, and put Tony Costa event in New York City in the subject line. We hope to see you Friday, July 6th, 6:30 p.m. to 10 p.m. at the First Baptist Church of New York City, on 79th and Broadway in Manhattan. And then coming up in November, actually, let me back up there for a minute. Before that event in November, there is another very important event that you need to know about in August. That's the Fellowship Conference New England. My dear friend, Pastor Mac Tomlinson, who is the pastor of Providence Chapel in Denton, Texas, organizes this annual event, and I thank God for Providence Chapel in Denton, Texas, because they have financially supported Iron Sharpens Iron Radio for quite a while and have bailed us out of some scary situations financially. And the Fellowship Conference New England is being held August 2nd through the 4th at the Deering Center Community Church in Portland, Maine. And there is no one theme on at this conference. As a tradition, they let each speaker speak on what is most pressing upon their heart and mind during the time of the conference. The speakers include Pastor Tim Conway of Grace Community Church in San Antonio, Texas, Pastor Mac Tomlinson, who I just mentioned, of Providence Chapel in Denton, Texas. He's also an author and a book editor and publisher. Pastor Jesse Barrington of Grace Life Church in Dallas, Texas, the sister church of Grace Life Radio in Lake City, Florida, whose radio station airs Iron Sharpens Iron Radio every day. Pastor Nate Pickowitz, who is an author and pastor at Harvest Bible Church in Gilmanton Iron Works, New Hampshire. And if you'd like to attend that conference, go to fellowshipconferencenewengland.com, fellowshipconferencenewengland.com. And then, as I said before, I was starting to say, the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals in November, the 9th through the 10th, is having their Quakertown Conference on Reformed Theology, not to be confused with the Reformed Town Conference on Quaker Theology. It's the Quakertown Conference on Reformed Theology at the Grace Bible Fellowship Church in Quakertown, Pennsylvania. That's November 9th and 10th, featuring David Garner, Ray Ortland, Richard Phillips, Timothy Gibson, and Carlton Wynn. The theme is the glory of the cross. If you'd like to attend this conference, and I will be there, God willing, with an Iron Sharpens Iron exhibitors booth, go to alliancenet.org, alliancenet.org, click on events, and then click on Quakertown Conference on Reformed Theology. Please tell them that you heard about the conference from Chris Arnzen on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. And as you have been hearing me say every day, I am so excited about the next G3 conference in Atlanta, Georgia, January 17th through the 19th at the Georgia International Convention Center in College Park, Georgia, which is a suburb of Atlanta. This will be my third G3 conference. The G3 stands for Grace, Gospel, and Glory. The theme this year is the mission of God. Or should I say the theme in January, is the mission of God, a biblical understanding of missions. And the very long roster includes such speakers as Paul Washer, John Piper, Stephen Lawson, Vody Baucom, Mark Dever, Conrad Mbewe, who I believe is the most powerful preacher alive on the planet Earth, the pastor of Kabwata Baptist Church in Lusaka, Zambia, Africa, and Chancellor of the African Christian University. Tim Challies, Phil Johnson, the Executive Director of John MacArthur's Ministry, Grace to You. Josh Bice, the Director of the G3 Conference. My friend Todd Friel of Wretched TV and Wretched Radio, and more. If you'd like to register for the G3 Conference, either as an attender or as a vendor booth operator, just like I will be there, manning an exhibitor's booth for the Iron Sharpens Iron Radio program. If you'd like to register for your own booth, whether it's for your business or your church or your ministry or whatever it is that you want to publicize there, they're expecting over 4,000 people at the G3 conference. So if you'd like to register for the booth or just to attend, go to g3conference.com, g3conference.com. And as always, please always tell all of our advertisers that if you're patronizing them, that you heard about them from Chris Arnzen on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. And now, very briefly, I just want to let you know that we are, as always, in need of your contributions here on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. I just thank God that my friends at BatteryDepot.com and Lynbrook Baptist Church on Long Island and the publishers of the New American Standard Bible have renewed their advertising contracts with me. I am praising God about that and so grateful to God for them. And also for you in the audience who have been donating to us after a dry spell where we weren't receiving any donations. Oh, thank you so much, all of you, and you know who you are, who have been donating to help us remain on the air. If you don't want us to hit another one of those really scary dry spells, please donate to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. If you love the show and you don't want it to disappear, go to ironsharpensironradio.com, click support, and click to donate now. Don't ever siphon money away from your regular giving to your local church where you are a member. Please, and if you're not a member of a local Bible-believing church, you need to join one because you're living in rebellion against God if you're not a member or prayerfully seeking for a Bible-believing church near you. I can help you. I have lists of faithful churches all over the United States and all over the world, actually. So send an email to me at chrisarnson@gmail.com if you need help finding a good church. But please don't siphon money away from your regular giving to that church. Don't put your family in financial jeopardy by giving to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. Those two things are commands of God, supporting your church and your family. Supporting my show is not a command of God, but if you love the show and you don't want it to go away and you're financially blessed above and beyond your ability to obey those two commands, then please consider sponsoring or donating to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. If you want to advertise with us, send me an email to chrisarnson@gmail.com, chrisarnson@gmail.com, and put advertising in the subject line. And if you just want to donate, go to ironsharpensironradio.com, click support, then click to donate now. And you could donate instantly with a debit or credit card. If you want to send in a check via snail mail, the old-fashioned way, an address will appear when you click support at ironsharpensironradio.com, where you can send that check made payable to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. By the way, if you'd like to join us on the air now with a question for our guest Thomas Isham and our co-host Ken Samples, our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com, chrisarnson@gmail.com, and please give us your first name, your city and state, and your country of residence if you live outside the USA, and please only remain anonymous if your question involves a personal and private matter. We do have a listener who actually has a question for Ken Samples, and I will allow it because of the fact that it involves some of what we are discussing today. Let's see here. We have Christopher in Suffolk County, Long Island, New York, who says, I know that there are conservative and more Anglo-Catholic Episcopalians converting to Eastern Orthodoxy in droves, and I also know that a former colleague of your co-host, Ken Samples, Hank Hanegraaff, converted to Eastern Orthodoxy. Can Ken cite what he believes the reasons for this is, not only in Hank Hanegraaff's personal experience, but in general? Because from what I know about Eastern Orthodoxy, their gospel is just as foreign to the biblical gospel as is the Church of Rome's set forth in the Council of Trent. You have anything to say about that, Ken?
Yeah, thanks, Christopher, for that very good and challenging question. I not only did Hank Hanegraaff, who is the current Bible Answer man, I worked at CRI both with Walter Martin and then for a brief period of time with Hank Hanegraaff.
That's how I first discovered you. I first discovered you when you were co-hosting with Hank on the Bible Answer Man. That's how I came to know who you were, and I invited you.
Right.
I invited you out to Long Island to preach at the church where I was a member.
That's right. We go back a long way. We're brothers. I think that's a really good question. I noticed a couple years ago that Richard Swinburne, who is a leading Christian philosopher, professor for a very long period of time at Oxford University, and he converted to Eastern Orthodoxy. Michael Ward, who is a specialist on C.S. Lewis, converted to Catholicism. And I'm going to offer my own perspective. I'd be interested as well in what Tom thinks about this. And Chris, I'd like to ask Tom another question about C.S. Lewis if we have time, but let me respond to that particular question. Here's my response. I think that in some cases, I think evangelicalism is perceived on the part of some individuals as being 30,000 miles wide and 2 inches deep. And that, of course, is an exaggeration. Evangelicalism includes many different Christian traditions, and some are very, very deep indeed. But I think some people are attracted to both Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy because their perception is that their evangelicalism doesn't go very deep. I agree with Chris's concern and criticism that not going deep into history takes you apart from Protestantism. I don't think that that's accurate. But I do think a good bit of the evangelical world is a bit light on history. I remember Yaroslav Pelikan, the started out Lutheran, wrote what I think is probably the best critique.
The Riddle of Rome, right? The Riddle of Romanism?
The Riddle of Roman Catholicism in 1960. I've quoted it many times. Late in life, he became Eastern Orthodox, and he was being he interviewed with the editor, one of the editors of Christianity Today, and he said, "You evangelicals, you talk too much about Jesus, but you don't think enough about the Trinity." I do think that some people join the Orthodox tradition and the Catholic tradition because they perceive evangelicalism to be light, historically and theologically. I think that's true of some in evangelical, but not all. In terms of some of the other people, like Richard Swinburne, he obviously has a deep awareness of the place of the Church of England in terms of history. I suspect that maybe his was for other reasons, maybe aesthetics, maybe, you know, other kinds of elements. But I think that obviously in the Eastern Orthodox tradition and the Roman Catholic tradition, you have these deep theological questions. But I think there are people who find the evangelical tradition to be, in their minds, somewhat shallow.
And many of us evangelicals agree with that. Many of us.
And I'm an evangelical who would agree with that,
yes.
to some degree. But I also don't want to overstate it. But I wonder what Tom thinks about this question.
Well, I concur with what you have already said. I think in the question there was something about a high church or Anglo-Catholic Anglican converting to Orthodoxy. And if that was part of the question, I can certainly see the attraction, especially with the liberal trends within the Episcopal and Anglican churches, that somebody who has a very conservative temperament and wants to be anchored in a tradition that certainly considers itself to be anchored in the ancient creeds and a very stable form of churchmanship. I speak of the various orthodoxies with a capital O. I can see where that would appeal. It's and it's another liturgical church, so an Anglo-Catholic would feel comfortable with that kind of worship, even though it's somewhat different than the Anglican high church worship, but it's still the liturgical type of church. And Ken said something about the aesthetics too. I think that's would kind of go along with the ritual and that aspect of worship would attract high church Anglo-Catholic types of people. As far as evangelicals converting to it, I guess some of the same reasons, actually. And Ken has pretty much touched on all of those. So
one of the things that does disturb me in the testimonies of converts that I have heard from evangelicalism to Eastern Orthodoxy and to Rome, although I agree, as I just mentioned and as Ken agreed, that much of evangelicalism today is really shallow and even heretical, and there are so many problems within evangelicalism, even among those that are most well-known, the most prolific writers and so forth. But at the same time, when I hear people abandoning ship and becoming Roman Catholic or Eastern Orthodox, very often the reasons are shallow. As my friend Reverend Jacob Smith over at the parish of Calvary St. George's Episcopal Church in New York City has called it, the phenomenon amongst Episcopalians called climbing the candlestick, where people are becoming more and more Rome just because they are enamored with the whole mystique, and some would find it beautiful, others would find it repugnant, but the whole imagery, the smells and bells, people become Romish, or they become Eastern Orthodox, or even Anglo-Catholic, because of that alone. And I find that disturbing, and I was wondering if you find that equally disturbing, Tom.
Well, I would certainly disagree with it. I think it bypasses the substance of the faith, and certainly as among us three here, we're evangelicals of a Reformed bent, which would be the more, generally speaking, the more sophisticated, I guess, deep form of evangelicalism. So I would not, it would be a superficial attraction, again, to bring up that word that Ken used, aesthetics, and that certainly appeals to a lot of people, and I wouldn't say it doesn't appeal to me at all, but I would simply go back to the reformational arguments and our own 39 articles, for that matter, even though they're roundly ignored these days by most Episcopalians. Just make the case on substance of what is the most true to the biblical, the scriptural teaching.
And by the way, there are people in highly liturgical churches like Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodox who become evangelicals for the wrong reason, very much a similar reason, but a different expression of the aesthetics and so on. You have Catholics joining evangelical churches just because they love the happy clappy atmosphere that some churches have today, and they love the fact that people give them a big hug after the worship service, and they love the fact that they have potluck suppers every week or month and that kind of thing. And so therefore you have these lost people, these goats in the midst of the congregation who are not really born again. They just like the way the people sing and the way they feel when they're going to these evangelical churches.
Mm-hmm.
Let me, if I might comment on that question, Chris. I know one thing that attracted me to the Anglican tradition was the depth of the Trinitarian elements reflected in the Anglican liturgy. The prayer book also attracted me. I just felt that it just enhanced my time of prayer. It challenged me both theologically as well as devotionally. Now, let me though touch that issue that you've raised, and I agree with your concern. I think when you decide whether you're going to be Orthodox or Roman Catholic or Protestant, I think you have to engage the question of authority, the relation of Scripture and tradition, and obviously you have to look very carefully at the question of salvation in terms of the relationship of grace, faith, and human works. I will tell you, however, that I was in a Anglican church in England just a few weeks ago. It was a church that had been since the Middle Ages, and so it was a Catholic church that then became an Anglican church. When I walked into the church and saw the way the aesthetic elements of the church, I wanted to worship God. And when I walk into a lot of evangelical churches, I don't feel that way. So, I don't think the bells and the smells and the aesthetic elements ought to be the first issue. But it's important to me, and there are even other evangelical traditions that I think that have more substance, but still that the Trinity in the liturgy has made a big difference. And as a person who has struggled to develop what I think is an adequate prayer life, the Book of Common Prayer has just been such a shot in the arm to me. So those are some of the responses. But obviously, if you're going to become Orthodox, Catholic, or Protestant, you need to engage the serious questions that were raised at the time of the Reformation.
Amen. And by the way, one of my favorite ads that my sponsors, Wading River Baptist Church on Long Island, is involving aesthetics that do play an important role. I'm not saying that there is no role at all, but the ad has, as many of my listeners know full well since I air it every day, are you tired of worshiping in a place that is more like a rock concert? And obviously that involves aesthetics and things like that that are disturbing because they're smothering the gospel message. They're removing reverence and awe and so forth. So I'm not saying that aesthetics mean nothing. I'm just saying that they shouldn't be the primary reason that you're joining one church and leaving another. And Ken, why don't you ask Tom your question about C.S. Lewis, and then we'll go to the break and we'll have Tom answer the question when we return.
Very good, Tom. C.S. Lewis, of course, was born in Belfast, Ireland. This idea of mere Christianity, I know that he saw it in Baxter. I wonder in your mind, and I've wondered this myself, if the friction between Catholics and Protestants, however that's to be understood, whether religious or more political in nature, if that didn't have a big influence on Lewis talking about mere Christianity. And I guess I wonder what you think of that idea of mere Christianity. Some are quite critical of it, obviously. Lewis does not explicitly emphasize justification by faith. He doesn't go after the question of authority as robustly as he does other things. But, of course, we have what you might call mere Protestantism. I mean, we have Christians who differ rigorously about how the ideal person to be baptized or differ eschatologically, but I mean, Chris has quite a diverse Protestant emphasis on the people who support his show. So I'm wondering what you think of that and how you work through Lewis's mere Christianity idea.
And then we'll have Tom respond to that when we return from our final break, which is a brief break. And of course, you could repeat in summary form what you asked when we return, Ken. This is your last opportunity, folks, if you want to join us on the air with a question of your own, and we do have several of you waiting, patiently, I hope, but our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com, chrisarnson@gmail.com. Please give us your first name, your city and state, and your country of residence if you live outside the USA. Don't go away. We'll be right back with Tom Isham and Ken Samples right after these messages from our sponsors.
Chef Exclusive Catering is in South Central Pennsylvania. Chef Exclusive's goal is to provide a dining experience that is sure to please any palate. Chef Damian White of Chef Exclusive is a graduate of the renowned Johnson & Wales University with a degree in Culinary Arts and Applied Science. Chef Exclusive Catering's event center is newly designed with elegance and style and is available for small office gatherings, bridal showers, engagement parties, and rehearsal dinners. Critics and guests alike acknowledge Chef Exclusive's commitment to exceeding even the highest expectations. I know of their quality firsthand since Chef Exclusive catered my most recent Iron Sharpens Iron Radio Pastor's Luncheon. For details, call 717-388-3000. That's 717-388-3000. Or visit chefexclusive.com. That's chefexclusive.com.
Lynbrook Baptist Church on 225 Earl Avenue in Lynbrook, Long Island, is teaching God's timeless truths in the 21st century.
Our church is far more than a Sunday worship service.
It's a place of learning where the scriptures are studied and the preaching of the gospel is clear and relevant.
It's like a gym where one can exercise their faith through community involvement.
It's like a hospital for wounded souls where one can find compassionate people and healing.
We're a diverse family of all ages,
enthusiastically serving our Lord Jesus Christ
in fellowship, play, and together.
Hi, I'm Pastor Bob Waldeman, and I invite you to come and join us here at Lynbrook Baptist Church and see all that a church can be.
Call Lynbrook Baptist at 516-599-9402. That's 516-599-9402, or visit lynbrookbaptist.org. That's lynbrookbaptist.org.
Iron Sharpens Iron welcomes Solid Rock Remodeling to our family of sponsors. Serving South Central Pennsylvania, Solid Rock Remodeling is focused on discovering, understanding, and exceeding your expectations. They deliver personalized project solutions with exceptional results. Solid Rock Remodeling offers a full range of home renovations, including kitchen and bath remodeling, decks, porches, windows and doors, roof and siding, and more. For a clear, detailed professional estimate, call this trustworthy team of problem solvers who provide superior results that stand the test of time. Call Solid Rock Remodeling at 717-697-1981, 717-697-1981, or visit solidrockremodeling.com. That's solidrockremodeling.com. Solid Rock Remodeling, bringing new life to your home.
Hi, I'm Pastor Bill Shishko, inviting you to tune in to A Visit to the Pastor's Study every Saturday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Eastern Time on WLIE Radio, www.wlie540am.com. We bring biblically faithful pastoral ministry to you, and we invite you to visit the pastor's study by calling in with your questions. Our time will be lively, useful, and I assure you, never dull. Join us this Saturday at 12 noon Eastern Time for a visit to the pastor's study, because everyone needs a pastor. Hi, I'm Pastor Bill Shishko, inviting you to tune in to A Visit.
Paul wrote to the church at Galatia, "For am I now seeking the approval of man or of God, or am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ." Hi, I'm Mark Lukens, pastor of Providence Baptist Church. We are a Reformed Baptist church, and we hold to the London Baptist Confession of Faith of 1689. We are in Norfolk, Massachusetts. We strive to reflect Paul's mindset to be much more concerned with how God views what we say and what we do than how men view these things. That's not the best recipe for popularity, but since that wasn't the apostles' priority, it must not be ours either. We believe, by God's grace, that we are called to demonstrate love and compassion to our fellow man, and to be vessels of Christ's mercy to a lost and hurting community around us, and to build up the body of Christ in truth and love. If you live near Norfolk, Massachusetts, or plan to visit our area, please come and join us for worship and fellowship. You can call us at 508-528-5750, that's 508-528-5750, or go to our website to email us, listen to past sermons, worship songs, or watch our TV program entitled Resting in Grace. You can find us at providencebaptistchurchma.org, that's providencebaptistchurchma.org, or even on sermonaudio.com. Providence Baptist Church is delighted to sponsor Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Charles Haddon Spurgeon once said,
"Give yourself unto reading. The man who never reads will never be read. He who never quotes will never be quoted. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read."
Solid Ground Christian Books is a publisher and book distributor who takes these words of the Prince of Preachers to heart. The mission of Solid Ground Christian Books is to bring back treasures of the past to minister to Christians in the present and future, and to publish new titles that address burning issues in the church and the world. Since its beginning in 2001, Solid Ground has been committed to publish God-centered, Christ-exalting books for all ages. We invite you to go treasure hunting at solid-ground-books.com. That's solid-ground-books.com and see what priceless literary gems from the past or present you can unearth from Solid Ground. Solid Ground Christian Books is honored to be a weekly sponsor of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
And don't forget, the book that we are discussing today, A Born-Again Episcopalian, is available at solid-ground-books.com, solid-ground-books.com for 50% off the list price. It lists for $24. You can have it for $12 at solid-ground-books.com. We are now back to our final 20 minutes or so of the program, and before the break, Ken Samples asked a question to our guest, Tom Isham, about C.S. Lewis. If you want to restate your question, but in more summary form, Ken?
Yeah, happy to do it. C.S. Lewis, of course, was from Belfast, Ireland, where there has been a long history of tension between Catholics and Protestants. I wonder what Tom thinks about whether that shaped Lewis's idea of mere Christianity. Then maybe on top of that, mere Christianity, of course, represents more of a Apostles' Creed, Nicene Creed emphasis, not touching upon questions of authority or justification. But Lewis, of course, said you can't live as a mere Christian. You have to decide on a church. You have to adopt a broader theological view. But I wondered what Tom thought and how, as an Anglican, how he thinks about that issue.
Yeah, well, fair. Excellent question. I'd never really given much thought to those the religious tensions in Northern Ireland being a factor in the mere Christian approach, but that is something to be considered. And, yeah, you just touched on something else about Lewis saying the mere Christianity idea was to get a person into the hallway, and then there are a number of doors that one can enter,
yeah.
You know, the Presbyterian door, the Anglican door, I suppose the Roman Catholic door, although he didn't specifically go that way. I think there may be something in that, him growing up in Belfast and being aware of the tensions in those days, just as they've continued down through the decades until, you know, I think they're fairly peaceful at the moment. But, yeah, I think that could be part of it. I think he seemed to be somebody who he felt certainly an obligation to propagate the faith after his adult conversion. And he took that very seriously and with the question to himself, where can I be most useful? You know, if I went out and proselytized for the Anglican Church, would I be the most useful? So he thought this broader approach would be his best approach to reaching people, I think, rather than getting into the narrower confessional views of the different denominations. And I know he says, I believe it's in the introduction to Mere Christianity, that he says, well, I am a layman in the Anglican Church, but I'm neither particularly high nor particularly low, and which would also contribute to his comfort with at least introducing Christianity as mere Christianity. I know that his good friend J.R.R. Tolkien was very disappointed in Lewis because he felt, and rightly so, he was involved in Lewis's adult reconversion, if you will, to the Christian faith, and he sort of felt that Lewis should have gone the Roman Catholic route, like Tolkien, of course, was an ardent Roman Catholic, and I think he was always a little unhappy with that, and he made comments to the effect, well, there's still a lot of Ulster in Lewis, Protestant and anti-Catholic view. So anyway, those are just some of my thoughts on it. And
Chris, could I speak in another question for Tom?
Yeah. Sure, go ahead.
Oh, sure.
You know, there's a famous quote from Calvin that the human mind is an idolatry factory. Mm. And obviously Catholics have the statues, the Orthodox have the icons. You know, in many Reformed churches, there's very little art other than music, and you hear the preached word, you sing. In the Anglican tradition, there is more aesthetic elements than that. as an Anglican, Tom, how do you sort through that? Some Protestant churches, in my opinion, seem plain. Obviously, the Orthodox and the Catholic churches go too far. How do you see that topic?
Well, I think it is speaks to the riches of the Anglican and Episcopal traditions that they, especially in its evangelical wing, such as it is today, and even more so in the past, that there is that rich Protestant, more confessional, word-oriented worship that is so important to evangelicals and Reformed Christians generally. And yet, they did, Cranmer, of course, did not jettison the beauties and even much of the liturgy of the Roman Church. I mean, the 39 articles, of course, draw distinctions, which are obvious. It was a church that split from Rome. And but Cranmer and Luther himself in the Lutheran tradition kept a lot of the Roman riches, if you will, of liturgy. In fact, when rarely I'm in a Roman Catholic church, I hear the same words, especially in the communion service, that I hear in the Episcopal Church here. And the Lutherans, which is very rare that I'm in a Lutheran church, but I hear, at least with the Missouri Synod people, it's the last group I was with, very similar words. So I just count it as a plus, and I'm happy that the Anglican tradition has kept that. But as you say, you know, it can be overdone. The really ornate Anglo-Catholic worship can get lost in the worship. You know, it's so much the physical, whether it's incense or, which is fine in proportion, or, you know, all the stained glass, the beautiful vestments. You can go overboard, the genuflecting and all sorts of things, but as long as it's within, it doesn't go overboard, I think it's an enriching aspect.
Thank you, Tom.
And by the way, I just want to throw in there, I want to promote a CD that I have loved for years. I don't know if either of you have heard this CD, but it is an a cappella Anglican choir, and the CD is called Brother Sun, Sister Moon, and the words that they are singing are very thoroughly biblical. There's nothing that would be uniquely Romish about any of the lyrics in the hymns that are being sung, and it's just a breathtaking CD, Brother Sun, Sister Moon.
I'll look for it.
I think that may be a quote from something St. Francis of Assisi wrote, which I'm not...
I believe it is, yeah.
I'm not crazy about that, but the words in the, the words in the hymns, I remember examining them specifically because some people might think it sounds very Romish because it is a Gregorian chant, actually. But it's the words are not idolatrous or heretical. We have Eric in Peekskill, New York, who has a question. I am a born-again Episcopalian and ordained minister in the Episcopal Church. And by the way, I do refer to the articles of religion often in my sermons. I am wondering if your guest believes there is a future for Reformed believers in the New Anglican Church of North America, ACNA. They seem sometimes almost as hostile to the articles and the classic prayer book as the Episcopal Church. And perhaps we could even have Ken chime in on that after you, Tom, because I think Ken's church where he worships is in the Anglican Church of North America, if I'm not mistaken. But Tom,
that's what I heard earlier.
Yeah, Tom, if you want to go first, and then we'll have Ken chime in there.
I think the ACNA is the largest group that split in recent years. A lot of it stemming initially from the consecration of a suffragan bishop who was openly gay and partnered. And so there was a lot of sorting out of things after that. And it was, I don't want to say so much that the ACNA folks left on their own. They were somewhat kicked out, I think, at least at some of the parishes were, because they were resisting certain developments in the Episcopal Church. But anyway, the last I heard, they have something like 100,000 members. So it's quite a thriving organization. Ken would know more about it than I do. I sometimes wish, although I understand completely why they were unsympathetic to what was happening in the Episcopal Church. We've chosen to stay, and for various reasons, but I certainly understand the opposite view. So I wish them well, and I do want to mention, in case any of your listeners would be interested, as far as the attack, the Episcopal Church, that's the mainline church, that used to be, at one time, it was the Protestant Episcopal Church of the United States of America. We keep taking words out of that, and now it's down to the Episcopal Church. But there is a body of evangelical and Reformed believers still in the church.
Yeah, just like my friend Reverend Jacob Smith that I mentioned earlier.
Exactly, and the man who just called, too. And there is an organization called EFAC USA. EFAC, E-F-A-C, stands for Evangelical Fellowship of the Anglican Communion. It's the USA branch, and somebody could, if they're interested, they could Google it. There's certainly they have annual gatherings. In fact, I spoke at their first one. They reorganized. They went out of business, so to speak, for a few years after the bishop's consecration that I mentioned that caused a lot of trouble. But then they reorganized, and they're back in business. They're a very lively group. If being a spirited group is going to help, they certainly have that. They've had conventions in Florida the last couple of years, which is quite a ways for us to travel, so we haven't been able to attend. And they've also met out in Pennsylvania at Trinity Seminary, and we did attend there. But anyway, so EFAC USA, if there are any conservative Episcopalians who need some support, at least online support, if you can't get to the next convention, just know there are other people out there, and they're doing their best to keep the evangelical tradition alive in the Episcopal Church.
Well, perhaps I'll get some of the people in leadership there on the show at some point. But Ken, you... Since you are, I believe, in the Anglican Church of North America now, do you have anything to say yourself about our listener's comment?
Yeah, I'm new to the ACNA. I have noticed some diversity in terms of people who tend more toward Reformed. Others have more of a Methodist leaning or leaning toward Wesleyanism. But of course, I think what's interesting, and I think that's where Reformed theology is different than, let's say, Lutheranism. I mean, you can be a Calvinist and be in the Dutch Reformed or the Presbyterian or the Baptist or the Congregational or the Anglican tradition. I think there's something unique. It's kind of an international element in Reformed theology. And I like the combination of the prayer book, the 39 articles, and some of the Reformed distinctives. I mean, it's appealing to me. I like the liturgy. I'm new, after spending quite a bit of time in a Dutch Reformed tradition, but I find it very appealing. And so I have to say, Tom, I'm pleased as punch that somebody has evangelical and conservative as you are in an Episcopalian tradition, and I wish you well, and I hope your number increases.
Thank you.
Okay, we have Joey in Clifton, New Jersey. This question is for either Tom or Ken or both. We tend to use the term Anglican and Episcopal interchangeably, and yet we also see that these churches, even into modern times, do distinguish themselves. I hope you can share some thoughts on how you view the distinctions in the Episcopal and Anglican churches, even if just in their modern expressions. I know this would probably be a confusing and multifaceted answer, but if you could give me some rough historical or present guidance, it would be appreciated. Thank you. Joey in Clifton, New Jersey. Isn't the difference, at least in its origins, the Revolutionary War, that the Anglicans in America changed the name of their churches to Episcopal?
Exactly. Really, the Episcopal Church is the American branch of the Anglican Church. The Anglican Church, of course, is the established church in England. It was, of course, in the colonies, the Anglican Church was, during colonial days, was present along with other denominations. After the war, as I say, the fortunes of what had formerly been the Anglican Church were at a rather low ebb for a couple of decades because a number of its members had been on the wrong side. Of course, George Washington was an Episcopalian or an Anglican, so, I mean, there were people who supported or even led the revolution. So in today's parlance, it'd be actually quite similar. Anglican still just fundamentally means the established church, and it's a way of describing or mentioning the established church in England. The Episcopal Church is very much, there's no governing aspect from the English church, but it's in that same tradition. Prayer books are very similar. The 39 articles are almost the same, except there is an article about the king and the queen, which obviously the American prayer book took out. no longer had a king or queen after the revolution, but other than that, the 39 articles are about the same.
Well, there are plenty of queens in the Episcopal Church, but that's another story. I'm sorry.
Yeah, right.
After the equivocation.
But, Ken, do you have anything to add to that?
I think that Tom's right on the money. I think that, I noticed there is also a Reformed Episcopal denomination. My interaction, again, they tend to be coming out of, the broader American Episcopal Church, and many of these churches that I have talked with, because of some of the liberal theology, have left and started their congregations. They're smaller, it is a huge. I mean, the real difference, the fundamental difference between a liberal theology and anything that is historically Christian, and so. I'm pleased that there are Episcopalians who are Orthodox, who are evangelical, and want to stand up for what that church has always believed. And so, I'm pleased to get to meet Tom, and I want to read his book.
And we have,
and I want to read yours.
Yeah. Okay, Melinda, who is also from Peekskill, New York. Let's see. Hi, Chris. Here's my question for your guests. The Episcopal Church today seems out of control sexually. For instance, the late Bishop of New York, Paul Moore, had many partners while married, as attested to by his daughter in an article in the New Yorker magazine a few years back. Is there any historical connection between the Episcopal Church and the free love movement of the 19th century? And I'm pretty sure that maybe that was meant to say the 20th century. I might be wrong. E.G. Shelley et al., and thank you, Melinda in Peekskill, New York.
Yes, Bishop Moore was, of course, an ardent liberal, and this information his daughter has revealed was rather surprising. He sort of embodied the liberal creed at its most extreme. In his own family, I believe he had 9 children, and then he was having multiple affairs, and not only with women but with men. So this man was a one man free love machine, I guess.
Sounds like Jim Jones.
Right. Yeah, Episcopal cult. But no, that was, you know, under the radar during his lifetime, although he supported every conceivable liberal cause and was liberal theologically, and loaned his diocesan cathedral out for some very weird goings on too, as I recall. He's been gone a while. So,
and we're running out of time rapidly, but is there any connection, as she asks, with the free love movement in the Episcopal Church?
The free love movement, if we're talking about, you know, the 20th century, the 60s, the hippies, that sort of thing, and whatever offshoots there are from that. No, that's not in the conversation.
Okay, and we are out of time, brother. We're out of time. If anybody wants to get a hold of Tom Isham's book, go to solid-ground-books.com, solid-ground-books.com. And if you want to get in touch with Ken Samples, go to reasons.org, reasons.org. I want to thank you both so much for being on the show today. I want to thank everybody, especially those who wrote in questions. And I want you all to always remember for the rest of your lives that Jesus Christ is a far greater Savior than you are a sinner.